Thank you very much for a very nice introduction, and I am very happy to be back. Nothing has changed really. The building got a little bigger, but my office mate is still here. Bianca, I'm happy that you are here today. All right, yeah, so I will talk about a computationally universal phase of quantum matter, and we will see what that is, but let's start with the hearing aid story. I think it's maybe not so closely related to computational phases of quantum matter, but let's see. So the reason that I bring this up is that Alex asked me to start with something general. And now our field is so broad, what could I review to start my talk with? So I've decided to talk about our field as a whole and how it is developing. So here's where the hearing aid story comes in. So I heard the hearing aid story in a bar in Tokyo in 2009. And it goes something like this. So sometime in the 1950s, the price of a transistor had fallen just below $100. And some engineer, either at Bell Labs or Raytheon or somewhere, he could buy one without asking his superior, and so he bought it and built a hearing aid with it. And the hearing aid became a very successful commercial device. And that brought down the price of the transistor, and then other things became possible, and so on and so forth. And that person who talked to me in that bar in Tokyo in 2009, he said, what we need in quantum information is a quantum hearing aid. And so now you wonder what that could be. I think probably some things would have popped to your mind in 2009, some things will pop to your mind now, some of these are the same, some of these are different. But that, he says, was what we need. And so the gist, I guess, of the hearing aid story is that kind of development of technology is kind of an interplay of engineering cleverness and economic forces. So somebody has a nice idea and that makes certain things possible, then economic forces kind of expand this whole idea and get you to a new equilibrium where everything is a little bit different than it was before, so maybe prices are different and so on and so forth. So new ideas become viable and then they kick off another such expansion period. And so step by step, you're getting to more and more complicated devices. All right, just a qualification. So I'm not saying that Minuteman missiles are a beacon of civilization. I've just learned that they were also very important in the semiconductor industry story. But okay, so this staircase goes on and on and on. Good. I just want to point out there are stories of a different kind. So, for example, the story of GPS. And I guess this is a slide where I have to apologize to Bianca because I'm talking about general relativity from the end of GPS, which is maybe a little bit of a distortion. But anyway, since we were talking about hearing aids before, why not talk about GPS? So GPS, to function properly, requires general relativity. General relativity, in turn, requires non-Euclidean geometry. And that was in the making for more than 2,000 years. So here, you have a completely different process of establishing something, of finding out something. So there was not really an economic adventure at any point in its trajectory, but it took a lot of time. And so you see, there is different trajectories of development, and you can wonder and ask the question, what is quantum computing going to be like? Yeah, just wanted to give you this outlook. There's a broader variety of possible trajectories. So let's ask our king. Let's see what he says. And I must say, so this opinion here is not the newest, so maybe it requires some addition or correction even, but I find it worthwhile to read you this comment. So let me do that. I think it's very revealing. So the question that Peter Shor asked in 2003 is, why have so few quantum algorithms been found to date? And I think kind of the same applies today. So here's what he says. The first possible reason is that quantum computers operate in a manner so different from classical computers that our techniques for designing algorithms and our intuitions for understanding the process of computation no longer work. All right. So yeah, that's one possibility. And the other possibility that he mentions, that maybe quantum computation isn't really good for so many things, and they have already been found. Okay, so but these are two possible alternatives, and I think they still stand today. Probably we have to add a few other alternatives. So for example, quantum simulation. I mean, quantum simulation has been around since 1982, so it was certainly there in 2003, but maybe it wasn't so big then. That is another alternative. So I would say that there's not a lot of intuition required in quantum simulation. You just do what physicists do. You take a Hamiltonian, make unitary evolution, trotterize, put it on a quantum computer. So this is a third avenue that certainly exists, and there's others. But I think also Shor's alternatives still exist. And what I want to focus on in my talk today is the first. So let's take this viewpoint for the purpose of my talk and say we need a different type of intuition to make useful quantum algorithms. Let's see where we can get this intuition. So this gets me now to my talk proper. All right, here is what we know. So this gets you to the area of what I want to talk about. So the subject is computationally universal phases of quantum matter. So let's talk, before we get to phases, let's talk about states first. So we know that certain quantum states have computational power, and this computational power is harnessed within the scheme of measurement-based quantum computation. So what you'll do is you have a quantum state, a suitable quantum state, of many spins, and then you'll compute. Oh, you have fantastic sound effects here. It's the first time that I experienced this. Okay, but there was nothing to underscore at this particular moment, so maybe we can coordinate this better. Where was I? Okay, cluster states. Yeah, so there are certain states in Hilbert space that give you universal computational power when you measure these states locally, one spin at a time. And so that gives you lots of measurement outcomes, and you can post-process them in simple ways to get computational outcomes. So this model of computation is equivalent to the circuit model, and it works on states. So a question that you can now ask is, how rare is it that a state drawn randomly from Hilbert space is computationally useful? And it is known that if you go by, what is that, Hilbert-Schmidt or something measure, invariant measure, you'll find that by far most states are not. Only the tiniest fraction of Hilbert space is potentially useful for measurement-based quantum computation. So these things are rare. Okay, but nonetheless, when you throw in symmetry, the situation changes a bit. So then you find entire phases of quantum matter that have a uniform computational power. And so this is what my talk is going to be about. And let's have Peter Shor in the back of our mind. So we want to, so this is a priori an interesting phenomenon, and we want to investigate it not for practical reasons, I mean, not for building a quantum computer in the first place or for making it robust to decoherence and so on and so forth. But in the first place, we study this to figure out which kind of structures come up when we think about quantum computation. So we want to change the point of view. And then maybe that helps us later with quantum algorithms. Good. All right. Maybe I should make one thing clear. When I say phase, I really mean phase in the sense of liquid phase of water, although I'm not looking into that phase, but not in the sense of e to the i-phi, okay? Physical phase. Good. So, here is our setting. So, as I already said, we're not looking into the liquid phase of water. We are looking at quantum phases at zero temperature. We are looking at spatial dimension 2, so this is a lattice of spins. Just a lattice of spins. And in the presence of symmetry. So symmetry is super important for this talk. So this is what this is our setting. And what we show in this setting is that there exist quantum phases of matter that allow for universal quantum computation in the framework of measurement-based quantum computation. So the point is that the computational power is uniform across the phase. So no matter where you are in the phase, you can pick any state in the phase, and it gives you the same computational power. Good. This is the result that I will establish. Okay. So this is in the framework of symmetry-protected topological order. As I said, symmetry is very important. So let us review this. So this is now a little review part of my talk. There's two things I want to review. Here is symmetry-protected topological order, and then measurement-based quantum computation. So I don't know what Bianca remembers about measurement-based quantum computation, but I think it is helpful if I go through this background material. So let's start with symmetry-protected topological order. Okay, so this is now about ground states of Hamiltonian. So consider some short-range Hamiltonian that is invariant under a certain symmetry that you choose. So the symmetry is a parameter that we choose here. We also say that we assume that for the phases of interest, the ground state is unique. Yeah. And so now the question is, what separates the various phases? So two phases are separated by a gap in, the shrinking to zero of an energy gap above the ground state. So whenever the energy gap closes, you can go from one phase to another. Without a gap closing, you stay in the same phase. So two points, so this is our parameter space. This is, of course, super high dimensional. It's not only two parameters, it's a high dimensional space. And so two points, that is two ground states, are in the same phase. Whenever they can be connected by a path such that symmetry is respected all along the path and the ground state energy gap never closes. So this is our definition of SPT phase. Okay, so now this other background material that I want to review, measurement-based quantum computation. So in quantum mechanics, we have two very different ways of evolving quantum states. We have unitary evolution and we have projective measurement. And they are kind of opposite extremes of one another. So unitary evolution, Schrödinger equation, is deterministic and reversible. So whenever I start with a fixed state, apply some unitary evolution, there is another unitary evolution, namely the inverse, that will get me back. With measurement, I can do that, at least according to the standard theory of measurement. If I measure a system, the state changes too, but it changes in such a way that it is impossible to go back to the state before the measurement. And also, unitary evolution is deterministic. There's no uncertainty into where in Hilbert space one is moving, but measurement is probabilistic. So the outcomes can, according to the standard theory of quantum mechanics, the outcomes cannot be predicted before a measurement is performed. Okay, so it turns out, so these are two extremes of quantum evolution, both, it turns out, can be used for quantum computation, and they give you the same computational power. If you use unitaries, this leads you to the circuit model, and if you use measurements that leads you to measurement-based quantum computation. And that's both fine, same computational power, as I said. So this was just kind of as a background remark. Let me now be a little more concrete about measurement-based quantum computation, to give you a bit more intuition of how it would look like. So you can envision it, and that we will do for the rest of the talk, as a two-dimensional grid. So you have a bunch of qubits here. So every dot on every arrow represents the location of a qubit. And so these qubits are prepared in some initial state that could, for example, be a cluster state, could be other things. And that cluster state, for example, is like a blank sheet of paper on which you can imprint any quantum computation you like by local measurements. And so this is what the symbols denote. The dots and the arrows, they denote different measurement bases. Okay, so let's talk about them. So the dots represent measurements, in this case, in the eigenbasis of sigma z, so what we call the 0-1 basis or computational basis. If we do this to the cluster state, the effect would be to just remove these qubits. The situation thereafter is as if these qubits had never been present. And you see what this does. So if it just removes these qubits, you end up with kind of like a network. And you think, oh, maybe that simulates a quantum circuit. And indeed it does. So what we namely can do now is we can chop up the remaining structure into areas that implement individual gates. So a line-like structure would just implement a wire if I measure every qubit, or like here, in the sigma x basis. So the upward and downward pointing arrows, they represent measurement in the x basis. And that just teleports quantum information across the cluster from left to right. And if I want to do unitaries, one qubit unitaries, I will just change the measurement direction into something different. Yeah, so this is how I'm getting my first logical gates. And if I want to do an entangling gate, say CNOT or conditional phase gate, well, then I make these bridges between two wires by, again, x measurements. And you see a circuit coming up. So again, the upshot is every region here can be identified with a quantum gate. That's how you simulate circuits in this model. Good. So this is by and large how it works. The cluster state is not the only universal resource state that's there. Other resources have been found. Maybe a prominent one among them is the AKLT state on a honeycomb lattice, for example. Good. So this is what I want to say about measurement-based quantum computation. Questions about that? I'm not going to call you out, Bianca. Okay, so it's just that. Good. Okay, then. Let's move on. So here's an outline of my talk. So first, I want to give you a short history of the question and our motivation, why we are looking into this. And then the second part of my talk is the actual construction, the proof that at least one computationally universal phase exists in two dimensions. Okay, so let's begin with the motivation and the history of the subject. So it says motivation number one. There's a number, but I only state one. Yeah, so as I already said, we are kind of fishing for structure. We want to figure out what kind of structure is important for quantum computation. And let's look at symmetry. So this is our idea. Let's see what symmetry has to say about quantum computation. We know symmetry is very important in all sorts of branches of physics, very important, for example, in particle physics. So elementary particles can be classified by symmetry. So maybe schemes of measurement-based quantum computation can be classified by symmetry. And if so, maybe algorithms can be classified by symmetry. So that is kind of our trajectory. So about the classification of measurement-based quantum computation by symmetry, it turns out we know a fair bit. About quantum algorithms, not really. So this is a question for the future, but I hope that we can establish techniques that will get us there. So that's our motivation. All right, so let me tell you a little bit about the history of the subject. So the history of the subject was kicked off in this very building by Akimasa Miyake, who is now at the University of New Mexico, with a scheme of, it was a hybrid scheme, part measurement-based quantum computation, part adiabatic computation. So it consisted of a chain of qubits that were in the ground state of some Hamiltonian, and as usual in measurement-based quantum computation, these spins were measured one by one. But that somehow didn't fit with the presence of a Hamiltonian, because you would excite, by measuring, you would excite the spin chain. And so to prevent that, the coupling between this last qubit and its neighbor in the chain was tuned off adiabatically before the measurement. And Miyake discovered that for this scheme to work, you didn't need to know what the Hamiltonian was, you didn't need to know what the ground state was. All you needed to know was that a certain symmetry was present. And he immediately realized that this is connected to the phenomenon of symmetry-protected topological order. So this is the starting point of this line of research. Good. Okay. So next step, we go to Sydney. So this is now measurement-based quantum computation proper. There's no adiabatic part in it anymore. But phenomenologically, it's a bit less. So what it does, it is not doing computation anymore. What it's doing is wire. So all it does is shuttling information from one side of a spin chain to the other side of the spin chain. But it does so all throughout a symmetry-protected phase. So again, you have this element of symmetry-protected topological order in here. So the reason I am mentioning this work is because it introduced the formalism of symmetry-protected topological order to the scheme, the use of group cohomology, and so on and so forth. So in all the works that came after this, they used the results from this paper. This became kind of part of the DNA of the subject. Good. But it was about shuttling information around only, not about computation. So Akimasa Miyake fixed this. So Akimasa Miyake found one particular phase of a spin chain that would allow universal quantum computation, but on a single qubit, on a single logical qubit only. Yeah? So that's what you get in 1D. So the wire was promoted to restricted computation. Okay, so Akimasa was back where he was already 5 years earlier, but now without the adiabatic element. So this is measurement-based quantum computation proper. So then I want to review or just mention two works, one by the group of Tsu-Chi Wei and one by my group. This is the SPT to MBQC meat grinder. Okay, so what is this about? So for those who are in the workshop that's currently taking place here and attended Akimasa Miyake's talk, he already alluded to the fact that SPT phases of matter are in one dimension are classified by group cohomology. So now, what the SPT to MBQC meat grinder gives you is you take that information of an SPT phase, which is the symmetry group corresponding co-cycle of group cohomology that describes the phase. So this is the description of the SPT phase. You put it into the meat grinder, crank lots of times, and out comes a measurement-based scheme of quantum computation that is complete with the logical gates that you can simulate and the logical measurements you can do. So in a way, this result gives us what we want. We go from a classification of SPT phases, which is by this group cohomology, to a classification of MBQC schemes. So this is kind of the prospect of this work, but there is a bottleneck or a problem with this work. It applies only to one dimension. And yeah, so there's a problem with one dimension. Let me explain to you what this is. So this is part, is it, Fantastic background noises here, so let's coordinate. Okay, so so this is part of a figure that you've already seen. At that time was part of a two-dimensional cluster, now it's a one-dimensional chain. So the fact is that when you're mapping measurement-based quantum computation to the circuit model, you're losing one spatial dimension. So when you're starting, say, with a two-dimensional cluster, you're mapping to a quantum register that's one-dimensional. That's fine. But if you start with a one-dimensional cluster, you're mapping to a zero-dimensional circuit model. That is, you have a fixed number of qubits. And well, you, in this way, you cannot be universal. So you need two dimensions at the least in your cluster state, two dimensions at the least, to have computational universality. And so this is our reason to go beyond one dimension. And all the results I have shown you so far are for spatial dimension one. And that doesn't suffice. So we need to go beyond. And so the question arises, is there a computationally universal quantum phase in two dimensions? And so this is now what this talk is about. Yeah, so indeed there is one, and I want to describe it to you. Good. All right, so here we go. So this is the result. So first, before I can tell you what the result is, I have to describe the setting to you. So we consider a simple square lattice on a torus. So locally, it looks like this. And globally, it looks like this. And the reason that we are putting it on a torus is that we don't like to discuss boundary conditions. But this is just out of laziness. The discussion of boundary conditions requires some care. And this is really the simplest situation. If you don't like it, you, without much more work, you can make it a tube. But kind of a planar sheet would be more difficult. OK, anyway, this is the global picture, and this is the local picture. So locally, we just have a simple square lattice. And these lines that you see here, they represent the action of the symmetry. So it is not so anymore that the symmetry is acting on every lattice site in the same way. Rather, the symmetry, or what's shown here as a generator of the symmetry, it acts on this diagonal line. So you have a sigma x Pauli spin flip here, 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 and so on and so forth. So this is a generator of the symmetry. That is another generator of the symmetry. And all the translates are also generators of the symmetry. So this is the symmetry that we are talking about. So that's called a subsystem symmetry. It already came up a bunch of times in the talks earlier this week. Good. So this is our setting. And we need one more element to describe the phase. So we are looking at the phase that has the 2D cluster state in it. So our phase will be the surroundings of the cluster state. OK? And the result says that in this phase that I just described, every state except possibly a set of measure zero is a universal resource state. So that's the result that I want to tell you about. Okay. So what's coming next is the proof of this result. So I have to introduce the tools that we are using. So what you see here is, what is it that you see here? Bianca? Tensor network. Okay. So maybe you use them in gravity too. It's a tensor network. Okay. And so every one of these little tensors represent one physical spin. And so kind of the emphasized leg of the tensor represents the physical system, a spin 1/2. And then all of these tensors, they have these virtual legs that ought to be contracted over to produce the resource state. So this will be our language here for this talk. And now, maybe you want to know where the quantum register is located in all of this. So this is measurement-based quantum computation. So you'll be simulating a quantum circuit, if you want that language. And So that simulated register has to live somewhere, and it lives exactly here. So remember, this is a torus. It has a short direction, which is short circumference, which is here. It also has this long circumference over here. And so the quantum register is living on these vertical, on these horizontal virtual legs of those tensors. Good. Just wanted to say that. Okay, so now my next slide is about the overall structure. Oh no, it's not. Sorry. Before I can tell you about the overall structure of the proof, I want to introduce to you cluster-like states. And the cluster-like states is the first use of these tensors. So cluster-like states I define to be states which have or whose tensors, whose MPS or PEPS tensors have these symmetries. So for example, here, I'm taking a Pauli operator, spin flip sigma x, apply it to the physical leg, and I take a bunch of Pauli operators, apply them to these virtual legs, gives me my tensor back. Okay? And well, here's another such symmetry, another such symmetry, another such symmetry. And yeah, so these are generators of a symmetry group. Whenever my MPS, or my PEPS tensors rather, have these symmetries, I call this cluster-like. And the reason for doing so, the reason of calling these symmetries cluster-like, is that if I adjust one other symmetry, then the symmetries in total uniquely define the state, and the solution is the cluster state. Okay. So if I have all these symmetries present, then I'm talking about cluster states. If this symmetry is missing, then I'm talking about cluster-like states. And they will feature very prominently in this result. Okay. So with this, the problem that I have to solve splits into two halves. So there's a lemma one and a lemma two. And the first thing that we'll show is that all states in the cluster phase are cluster-like. And the second thing that we show is that if I have a cluster-like state, then except of a measure zero, it is a universal resource. Okay, so this is how the proof of our result splits up. And yeah, now I want to show you how we prove these lemmas. Okay, so let's talk about part A first. So just to remind you what we have to do here, so we are starting with those symmetries that act on the physical quantum state, and we want to derive a symmetry that acts on these PEPS tensors. And we want to show if this symmetry is present and we are talking about the cluster phase, then these symmetries follow. So that is our goal here. So let's see how we go about it. Okay? So we are using a result from a literature saying that if we have a state in the cluster phase, it must be related to the state in the center of the phase, the 2D cluster state, by a bunch of unitaries that are short range and symmetry respecting. So the symmetry holds on the level of every one of these unitaries. So we look how this constrains those unitaries. So what we can do is we can take each one of these little unitaries and expand it in the Pauli basis and wonder, okay, which of these Pauli operators commute with all the symmetries? And if we do that, we find that there's actually not that many possibilities. So here are the generators. So either, of course, since the symmetries act by Pauli operators X, you have every combination of Pauli operators X that commute with the symmetry. For the Zs, is actually somewhat more constrained. So you find these, okay, and you can immediately that this is the case. So remember, the symmetries act on these diagonal lines. So every symmetry will either miss this arrangement or hit it twice. And so indeed, these operators commute with the symmetry. All right, and then there's a third kind, and they look like this. So they are pairs of Pauli operators, sigma z's, halfway across the torus. So these line-like symmetries, they go around like this, and then go on and on and on. But anyway, they go around like this, hit both of them, and the other symmetries goes around like this and hit both of them. So this is another solution of these constraints. And I claim, without proof, that this is all that you can have. Yeah? Everything is generated from those. All right. So now, they can be discarded because, remember, in our circuit, every gate has to be short range, and they are not short range. So they can be removed from the expansion, so that gets rid of those. And you can also get rid of those because your unitaries are acting on a cluster state, and so you can multiply these guys with the corresponding cluster state stabilizer, and this gives you a Pauli operator sigma act. So this is really all that you have, and that is important in the next step. Okay, so now here is, we are back to our PEPS tensors, or a state somewhere in the cluster phase, and it can be described by the perfect tensor, that's the tensor for the cluster state, connected by a link to this, to what we call the junk tensor. And the junk tensor contains all the information about the unitaries. So what matters from all the argument that I have given you so far is that what you have inside this box is just a bunch of identities and Pauli operator sigma x. And so what this means is that the Pauli operator x applied to the physical leg of this box commutes through. And that's the only property that we really need of it, this commutation property. And so now we can show that also the tensor somewhere in the phase has the same symmetries as the cluster tensor. Let's just do this in an example. So this is one of the symmetries that we had, that we asserted for the cluster tensor. So let's just kind of put them around here. Let's see what this does. Okay, so we've just split up the tensor somewhere in the phase in its two parts, the junk part and the cluster part. And we are now using the commutation property here. So this commutes to down here. And now we're using the symmetry of the cluster tensor to absorb all these Pauli operators. So that gets us to this, which is this. So this is the proof that any tensor in the phase shares all these symmetries with the clusters. Good. And that is kind of, that completes the first part of the proof. So we wanted to show that any state in the phase can be described by PEPS tensors that have these symmetries. Good. And now we want to play Lego with these symmetries. So the second part is to find out how these tensor symmetries help us with the computation. So we weave them into large pattern, which is really kind of playing Lego. So let's do some of that. So what you see here is our lattice again, or just kind of a section of it. So remember, we have periodic boundary condition. Periodic boundary conditions in this direction, but on the horizontal, I mean, the horizontal extension of the state is much longer. Yeah. Okay. So now let's kind of, so we have a quantum register here, and so we can have a Pauli operator sigma z coming in to this arrangement, and we can see what it does, how it comes out of it. Okay, and so we're looking at a section of the cluster that is as wide as the circumference is here. And then you see the following. So what we're now using here is these cluster symmetries that I spoke about for the last 10 minutes or so. So we just kind of play Lego with them. We assemble them in such a way that outgoing and incoming legs match. They have the same Pauli operator attached. And so we have no links remaining internally here on the virtual legs. And so what's happening is the Z operator that goes in comes out in the same location. But it leaves Pauli operator sigma x behind on a bunch of the physical qubits. So the way how I get rid of those is measure every qubit here in this section in the sigma x spaces. So this is how we get our first computational primitives, just by measuring every qubit here in this section of the cluster state in the x basis. And so that results into, well, Pauli operators coming in, getting out unharmed. And the same happens for the Pauli operators of x type. It's exactly the same style of calculation. Remember, this leg that's coming out here is coming in on the other side. It's periodic boundary conditions. OK, so this gives us the identity gate. Just the identity gate. We had to work quite hard for it, but that's the first thing that we get. So the two messages to take away from this is when we measure every cluster qubit in the x spaces, this gives us wire. And the second message to take away from it is that you see these symmetries help to do computation. But of course, we don't want to talk about wire, we want to talk about computation. And that's coming up next. So let's play with a measurement basis. So this is first for the cluster state itself. That is a more familiar scenario. And from there, we will go into the cluster phase. But let's discuss the cluster state first. So what you see here is this tensor network. And over here, we have a slightly simplified situation. I mean, a slightly simplified graphic explains the same story, but it just shows the individual lattice sites. OK, so what we're now asking ourselves is, what happens when we tilt the measurement basis at a particular qubit slightly away from the sigma x eigenbasis towards the sigma y basis, just tilted by some angle? And it turns out that these symmetry relations are again useful. So there's a Pauli operator sigma x associated with this measurement that can now be propagated forward by one slice, and we find that it propagates it into something non-local. And it turns out this something non-local will turn out into a non-local unitary gate, maybe this gate. And I can now ask myself, all right, if I change the measurement basis away from the sigma x basis to something else in some other location, what do I get? And I get, if I do it over here in the last column, I get a one-qubit rotation about the x-axis. If you do it in the first column, I get a one-qubit rotation about the z-axis. And of course, I get all the translates of these gates. And it turns out that is a universal set of gates. Okay, so we are done for the cluster state. This is our universal set of gates. So when we go into the cluster phase, there's only one. There's a paper that gets you from here to here. Yeah? So it looks like a simple step. the argument is somewhat involved, but the result is simple. So when you go into the cluster phase from the cluster state, all that changes is that you pick up a number, which is of magnitude equal to 1 or smaller than 1, typically smaller than 1. So when you measure in a fixed basis, if you are somewhere in the cluster phase as opposed to the cluster state itself, all this means that your rotation angle has become smaller. That's the only effect that it has. Otherwise, it is completely the same. But large rotation angles, small rotation angles, you can always ramp up the rotation angles by repeating the rotation. And so the computational power is exactly the same. Good. And so this completes the proof. Yeah? So this is the result. We have at least one computational phase that has universal computational power throughout, has a uniform computational power. And I should say there's a bunch of other works that generalize this result to cluster phases on various lattices. And I just want to remind you of Akimasa Miyake's talk earlier this week, who presented some of these constructions. Good. All right, so that's the result. Have we learned anything? Yeah, so there's two things that I want to kind of remind everybody of. So the first thing is, I mean, this is interesting phenomenology. And so far, what we had known all applied to one dimensions, to one spatial dimension, which is somewhat restricted in its applicability and usefulness. So we have a construction here in two dimensions, and so it gives you a computationally universal phase. So yeah, so this means that the idea of computational phases of quantum matter extends all the way to universality, to computational universality. So it is an interesting phenomenon to study. So that's what we have established. And the other item I want to talk about is about the symmetries. So symmetry played a very important role in my arguments, and I think maybe that's an object for systematic study. I mean, we haven't done any systematics about it, no classification, but maybe that would be an interesting thing to do. And let me, in the remaining few minutes of my talk, let me elaborate a little bit on that. Okay, so before we go to classification, let's just modify everything a little. So let's not talk about the tensors that describe cluster states or cluster-like states. Talk about different tensors. And one simple modification that we can make is we take the tensor that we already have and just apply a bunch of Hadamards on various virtual links. It seems a trivial modification. So let's see what happens if we do that. So what happens if you do that is that you get the following symmetries of your tensor. And if you look at that, it actually gives you a Greenberger-Horn-Seilinger state. And we know that the Greenberger-Horn-Seilinger state is not useful for quantum computation. And it's not useful. So this modification has changed something rather dramatic. And now, at this point, you may begin to see, oh, well, maybe let's enumerate or classify all the possibilities that are there and sort out those that are good from those that are bad. Let me just talk a little bit more about this cellular automaton idea. I didn't introduce it in my talk, but for those who are at the conference, they will have heard of it from Akimasa's talk. So basically, to explain it briefly, what I'm now talking about on my last slide is the progression, say, from here to the next slice. Yeah? So here I did a whole block at once. Now we are going through it slice by slice. Okay, so let's do that first for the cluster tensor. And so what you see is the following. So you have an incoming Pauli operator sigma x, and by the symmetries that we have in the cluster phase, this sigma x is propagated to a non-local operator. In fact, we saw just that on a previous slide when we were discussing gates. And likewise, if you propagate a sigma z, it turns into a sigma x. So this is the action, precisely the action, of a Clifford cellular automaton. So here you see how all of this is related to Clifford cellular automata. And so now, knowing this, you could ask yourself, okay, so what cellular automaton is defined by the symmetries of this GHZ tensor? So one of the symmetries gets you immediately that the Z propagates through at the same site. But with the X, you get difficulty. So you have an X coming in, it goes to all other legs, and therefore you have to attach a symmetry at the neighboring tensors, and so you have an X coming out here and here at the input side. So this is not a transmission. Here you have transmission, here you have transmission and reflection. So this is not what you wanted. So this this cellular automaton will restrict you rather severely. So what you're getting here, you had, so you can talk about the throughput, the number of qubits that can be transmitted from one side to the next. And over here, this is n, the size of the circumference. Is that a call for me? No. Okay. Good. Over here, on the other side, it turns out you get one qubit worth of transmitted qubits. So only if you have all the x operators here, they'll go through, and this gives you one encoded qubit of transmission. And so the benefit of the second dimension is entirely lost. Okay. Good. I just want to illustrate that it might be interesting. So you see this very different behavior just from making a tiny modification. And so I just want to illustrate, so maybe it is indeed interesting to classify these symmetries. And that brings me to the end of my talk. So just to summarize this one more time. So we have shown that there exists at least one a computationally universal symmetry-protected phase in two dimensions. By now, we know quite a number more. So there is more here in this paper. It makes also the relation to quantum cellular automata. And then, I mean, Akimasa's talk earlier this week provided a very large family of computationally universal phases. And on the technical side, we have symmetry Lego. That should be fun. So yeah, if you're interested, try it. Okay, who's get to throw?
Okay, thank you very much. So actually, it's our customary to take first questions from students. So have any questions? Don't be shy. Or you can pretend like a student and ask naive questions.
Hi, thank you for the very nice talk. I had one naive question about the number nu that changes the angle of rotation.
Mm-hmm.
Does this like sort of goes to zero when you closes the gap so that like you cannot rotate anymore when you go out of the phase or something?
Yes, we expect that. I guess, but we haven't done the numerical analysis. I guess we should really do that. But that's what we expect, that nu goes to zero precisely at the location of the phase transition. And I mean, it really doesn't stay constant until it then drops, but it kind of smoothly goes to zero as we approach the phase transition. Yeah, but I guess we should confirm that numerically, what the behavior is.
Thanks, Robert. I just wanted to know your thoughts on the connection to the topological measurement-based scheme. So there's some sense in that model being topological should be, in some sense, a property of a phase and robust to perturbations. But it seems I have trouble seeing how to connect what you presented here with that sort of scheme.
Yeah. So there is no quantum error correction style protection here. So, and this is because of this number nu. So when you run a computation, you would need to use part of your state to find out what nu is. Just kind of do a little calibration experiment, find what that number nu is, and only once you know that, you can then compute. Yeah, and because it is sensitive to what nu is, it is not in the same class of things as fault-tolerant quantum computation.
But would you not be able to do any of the type of sort of operation through grading that you can in the topological scheme and have those robust to exactly where you are in the faith?
Yeah, so you want to do this in a fault-tolerant fashion. So the best we know, I mean, I would say all we know, even if you know maybe 100 phases right now that are universal, all of these are cluster phases, as cluster-like phases, as far as I know. And so probably your best bet would be to start, if you want the fault tolerance, with a cluster state, with a 3D cluster state. And that would be your best bet, okay? And now the question, one question now is, what do you do about the rotations? So one thing that I suppressed here in the talk was that as soon as you move away from the cluster point, you need to acquire these rotation angles in small increments. You are forced to limit yourself to measurement bases close to the X bases, which give you small rotation angles. Now, so that gives you a little bit of trouble with your magic state distillation procedure or whatever fault-tolerant technique you would want to use. But I see no fundamental obstacle. You could still acquire your rotation angle bit by bit. But the longer it takes, the more suffers your fault-tolerance threshold. So at this moment, I mean, I think you must have spent much more thought on which symmetry to impose if you want to do this in a fault-tolerant fashion in a 3D case. I haven't thought about it. I think that should be doable, but, and I see no, at this moment, I mean, without having thought of it for too long, I see no fundamental roadblock. But what I would expect is that the threshold shrinks the more you move out into the phase, the fault-tolerance threshold.
Any other question?
Hi. I was wondering, can one actually use the computational power to define a phase? Or are there some kind of obstacles to use this as a... I mean, you're using a conventional definition of a phase, right?
Mm-hmm.
Through like finite depth circuits,
yeah,
or something like that. And then you're showing that throughout that phase, you have universality,
yes,
at the measurement-based computation.
Yes.
But could one maybe conversely try to say, to define a phase via some way of saying that measurements are universal for computation?
So the inverse meat grinder, maybe that would be the inverse meat grinder.
No. I mean, the meat grinder relates to different concepts of defining a phase, right?
Yeah.
My question is, like forget SPT and whatever, just can you define the concept of a phase through the computational power of the state? Is that something which allows us, which suffices the definition of it?
I believe the amount of computational power you get, or the gate set that you get, is just a property of the phase. So there will
but
be different...
Say, wait, when you say phase, you mean a phase defined in the conventional way?
Now let's talk about the, I mean, all I can really talk about is SPT phases in dimension one, and in higher dimension, the subsystem symmetry phases.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? But what in dimension one, for sure, there's different phases with different symmetry groups that give you the same computational power. So computational power alone cannot...
Maybe I shouldn't have used the word phase. Let's invent a new word. Cube. A phase in the conventional sense is an equivalence relation on, say, the space of Hamiltonians, if you wish, or maybe on the space of ground states, which is defined through Hamiltonians, and that's what we call a phase.
Mm-hmm.
Could you define an equivalence relation in some way based on the computational power, which would have the corresponding nice properties, nice structure of the set,
to
sensitivity,
me,
and so on?
To me, computational power is not sufficient. I can only repeat what I said, so I must be missing something in your question. For me, computational power is not sufficiently discriminating. It is just kind of too little to know about a phase to classify. Okay, let's talk more later.
Actually, I have a kind of relevant question, but from different angle. So you and Sergey Bravi show that actually toric code is useless for measurement-based quantum computation. Mm-hmm. So is there any actually phases, let's say, nearby to toric code under some symmetry where like some phases might actually feature not useful?
Did you just say point group?
No, some nearby phases of the toric code which mm-hmm. are actually not useful. It's like kind of the common expression.
Well, all right, we haven't, okay, so definitely a toric code is useless. So we haven't studied the uselessness of the toric code phase. I do not know. But you can ask this question to Norbert. I think Norbert has a paper from the 9007 or 8-ish, I believe, where he is playing with the toric code in seemingly minor ways and getting a universal resource state out of it. Norbert, is that correct? Good. So there seem to be, so I think it's that you can have a one parameter family that gets you from the toric code state, which is guaranteed useless, to another state, which is not too different from the toric code state, but computationally universal. And if you could go beyond these extreme points, you could perhaps study whether the physical phase transition coincides with the phase transition in computational power. And maybe Norbert has done that already, but I wouldn't know. But I think that would be maybe a setting to look at.
Any other question? Okay, if not, let's thank Robert again.